In my younger and more vulnerable years, my father gave me some advice, but I forgot it, so let's talk about The Great Gatsby instead. Welcome back to Sophomore Lit. If you're highlighting everything in the book, it's the same as highlighting nothing. I'm John McCoy, and with me this week is my special guest, Carla Kurtzinger. Carla, would you like to tell us something about yourself?
Sure. I met John in 2000, so that was 15 years ago, when we both worked on Car Talk together. And now I live in New York City, and I do freelance work in communications and marketing. That's me.
Carla actually asked to do today's book, The Great Gatsby. Carla, is this a favorite of yours, or is it just something you feel qualified to talk about?
Well, I don't know if I feel qualified to talk about it, but I remember this is an instance where I saw the movie before I read the book. The movie came out, and I went back and checked this to make sure my memory was accurate, but the movie came out in 74 when I was 11. And that version of the movie starred Robert Redford and Mia Farrow. And I loved Robert Redford. So anything he was in, I went to see. And I really liked the movie. And so a few years later, when I was in sophomore lit and our teacher, Miss English, mentioned we were going to read the book, I was excited to read it because I liked the movie so well. So in some ways, it was understanding the film several years later, because I don't know that I understood all the nuance until I read the book. And my teacher was very interested in the symbolism of the book. So it was, I really enjoyed it because I kind of had that movie experience.
And did you see the Baz Luhrmann film?
You know, I have to admit, I'm going to be one of those people. The promo really turned me off because it was, you know, if you've seen the Robert Redford version, it was a very quiet, I felt very studied performance. Even though they were doing the jazz era, everything about it to me seemed very quiet and nuanced. And then when I saw the promo for Baz Luhrmann, it was, you know, it was a Baz Luhrmann film. So it was so over the top that the promo kind of turned me off. I didn't see it in the theater. I did later see it on demand, and I got through about 10 minutes and I realized it just wasn't The Great Gatsby for me.
I'll do you even one worse. I haven't seen either film, so.
And there's been another one as well that I didn't see that had Tobey Maguire in it.
Okay, well, a little background on The Great Gatsby. The Great Gatsby was published in 1925 by F. Scott Fitzgerald. F. Scott Fitzgerald was born in Minnesota, and he was actually like a third cousin or something to Francis Scott Key, which is where he gets his F. Scott. He grew up variously in Buffalo, New York, St. Paul, and Hackensack. So as we'll see as we go along in the book, his life in some ways mirrors that of The Great Gatsby. He did go to Princeton for a while, but he got bad grades there because he was trying to be a novelist at the time. After he dropped out of Princeton, he went to the Army, and while he was studying to be a second lieutenant in Montgomery, Alabama, he met Zelda Sayre, the great love of his life, Zelda Fitzgerald, who we will also see is sort of like Daisy in the book. Fitzgerald met Zelda Sayre as a second lieutenant, and at the time he was too poor to marry her because she was the daughter of an Alabama Supreme Court justice, and he was only able to go through with the marriage in 1920 after publishing This Side of Paradise, which was an instant success and the biggest success he had in his lifetime. The Great Gatsby itself was not a financial success, and only after his death became recognized as his great novel.
You know, I don't remember our teacher talking too much about the author himself. I mean, I'm familiar in a very passing way, but that it's interesting that it makes the book seem so much more autobiographical when you describe that.
There's a lot of interesting parallels with Fitzgerald and all of his novels. Fitzgerald, in his lifetime, probably made most of his fortunes from selling popular stories to Saturday Evening Post, and those were kind of much more genre-driven. Apparently, Hemingway used to tease him about that, calling him whoring to the public. But I remember in my high school class that we read this around the same time that we read McTeague and Sister Carrie. So this was another in a long list of books about the failure of the American dream.
I have no memories from high school. No, I do remember in this class, though, because Miss English was, I was fascinated by her because she was the only single teacher we had. So it was very interesting to have a young single teacher. But I remember in this class, she had us read The Great Gatsby. We also read 1984, which continues to be one of my favorite books, and Fahrenheit 451. So I felt like a lot of the books that she had us read focused on the decline or, society that either had come to a point where it was, imploding or, and then of course in The Great Gatsby, it was almost like a dream that, Greg Gatsby thought he knew what he wanted, as far as, Daisy, obviously what he wanted ultimately, but he had to achieve such great success, he thought, to get her. And then he had all the success and it wasn't enough. So yeah, I felt like there was definitely a theme in all the books that she had us read. They weren't uplifting necessarily, but I really enjoyed all three of those.
This book does star the narrator, Nick Carraway, who from the beginning of the book tells us that he is a very non-judgmental type. That's how the book opens. It talks about how his father told him never to judge another man. And that kind of colors the way that we're supposed to view this book. Because in many ways, this book is full of horrible, dislikable people. Doing this allows Fitzgerald to have us hang out with these people through the eye of someone who claims to not judge anyone. But one of the things I think about Nick is he kind of belongs to that tradition of Ishmael type narrators, where there's a narrator who's ostensibly there for all the action, but really doesn't have much effect on anything or really much of a personality.
When I think about narrators, I often have a negative point of view because I feel like sometimes they pull you out of the story because they're there just to kind of say, and then something happened, and then you get into what's happening, and then they're like, and then we're back. But to your point, he was actually part of the story, but almost seemed like a framework without much going on. I always think about him having Gatsby and Daisy meet at his house, and then he just kind of steps aside. And that's when you realize that he really was just there to, as a conduit for what was going to happen between them. So I felt like he was very ineffectual, but necessary.
Right. But the weird thing is that after he introduces Gatsby to Daisy, he still hangs out there with them when they're apparently carrying out this affair. He's also dragged along by Tom to meet his mistress.
Yeah, I guess as a narrator, you are forced to be a little bit of a voyeur. And it seems like his friends, wanted him to see. And, some of that, I feel like, it kind of goes back to this is more Gatsby's issue than Nick's, but that idea that, the rich have a certain lifestyle and those of us on the fringes can only watch. So in some ways, it's like Nick is sitting back and watching everyone else, have affairs and have money and have the women or men that they want. And he was just there to watch. But that was kind of his role because he had to report back to us what's going on.
Well, Nick Carraway, we're told, has moved from the Midwest. In fact, everyone from this book apparently seems to have moved from the Midwest, as Nick remembers at the end of the book. He's coming to West Egg, Long Island, to be a bonds trader, which is a kind of a great move because it's something that nobody understands. It's just some sort of financial job, and he's going to make a lot of money. He's going to come, and he comes to West Egg, which is the less reputable of two cities, West Egg and East Egg. When I read this, not when I read it as a high schooler, because I had no context, but when I read this now as an adult, I thought immediately of Gulliver's Travels, where the one island is full of little Indians and the other island is full of big Indians who eat their eggs on either side, and that's the basis of all their conflict. And I thought this had to be some sort of a comparison.
Wow, that's very literary. That's very literary. I've never made that connection. But you know, having now that I live in New York City, I just thought of it actually as just being the cities. Now, when I read it, like you, lived in Kentucky at the time and didn't know one from the other. I somehow in my mind even thought that that was mythical places that were just created.
Well, there are no West Egg. As far as I know, there's no actual West Egg or East Egg in Long Island. But Long Island is, of course, a very real place, and at the time was where all the super rich hung out. I think it may be different these days, although
it depends on, again, it's which end of the Long Island. You know, there are neighborhoods closer to New York City that are more regular neighborhoods, and then as you get farther, you go farther out toward the east, you'll get Montauk and Ditch Plains, and I'm not even thinking of all the places, nicer places that you can live out there.
Well, Nick Carraway gets a house at West Egg, and he is living next door to an enormous mansion. He's told that it belongs to a guy named Gatsby, who we don't see at first, but we're also told that he lives across the bay from East Egg, which is the much more fashionable place where the old money lives. And among the old money is his second cousin once removed, Daisy Buchanan, who has married Tom Buchanan, who is a very wealthy guy who was also a highly successful athlete in his youth, although these days he doesn't do much other than run around the place and have affairs and live an ostentatious lifestyle.
But no judging.
No judging. No judging at all. He's invited over to their home, and when he comes to their house, he also meets Jordan Baker, who is a golfer, a woman who will become his love interest through the book. I mean, that is Nick's love interest through the book. And when we see them all, we see Daisy depicted as this incredibly vacuous, idle rich, and yet she's also a great beauty and someone who is described as having a very melodic voice. There's a line here very early on where Fitzgerald talks about her. He says that she has the kind of voice that the ear follows up and down as each speech is an arrangement of notes that will never be played again. And that line is sort of like what you get from Fitzgerald throughout the book. Fitzgerald is drawn to these kinds of beautiful passages of writing. And that kind of sets him apart, I think, from the other writers we think of at this time, certainly from people like Hemingway, who would have championed a much more simple style, or someone like Faulkner, who has a much more obtuse style. Fitzgerald is very musical himself in his writing.
You know, I was 14 when I read it, and I found it, to me, I found it in some ways, again, I'd read it backwards, so I'd seen the movie first, and I felt like having faces in my mind, you know, with Robert Redford and Mia Farrow, I felt like the way he described Daisy especially was so spot on, if you will. And I kept thinking that if he were in the casting chair, he would have been so happy to see how they had picked a person or an actress who really embodied, you know, the woman that he had described. And to your point, he describes in such a lyrical way. But yeah, I found as a younger reader, or a young adult reader, which is what we call them now, I felt like it was easy to read, and romantic language that I appreciated then.
She's described as a golden child. That was also Zelda Fitzgerald's nickname. Zelda was a great beauty and a society woman, and I know that in some ways, the more you learn about Zelda, the more it kind of is distressing, the fact that Daisy kind of parallels her, because of course Fitzgerald spent his early life chasing after Zelda the way that Gatsby spends his life chasing after Daisy.
Remind me, John, where did this book fall in his list of books that Fitzgerald wrote? Was this first, or
this was the third novel? He'd written This Side of Paradise. The second novel was The Beautiful and Damned, and they both books had characters in it that seemed very like Zelda Fitzgerald. In fact, when they did the first edition of The Beautiful and Damned, the publishers asked Zelda to write a blurb for the cover, and she chided Fitzgerald for stealing all of her personal life to write about it, and said, in fact, there's a line, he says, "Mr. Fitzgerald, I believe that is how he spells his name, seems to believe that plagiarism begins at home." So this would go on throughout their life. I know that Zelda Fitzgerald wrote her own novels based on her life, and F. Scott Fitzgerald was very upset with her for doing that. He thought that she was stealing the material that he was going to use.
That's funny. Well, you know, I remember just from my class with Miss Hayden, you know, of course, she was very into the symbolism of the story, and she kept talking about all the references to gold and green, to your point about the golden, was it golden girl, golden child?
Right.
You know, she said that was very deliberate on Fitzgerald's part because it was the focus on money.
When Nick comes over to visit Tom and Daisy, Jordan lets Nick know that Tom has a mistress. It's not a very well-kept secret. And in fact, shortly after this, Tom takes him off to see his mistress, a woman named Myrtle Wilson, who lives in a place called the Valley of Ashes, which is this place between New York City and Long Island, where all of the burnt ashes from fireplaces and furnaces are dumped. It's highly symbolic, as are many things in this book. And there's also, overlooking the Valley of Ashes, a huge billboard that has the eyes of Dr. T.J. Eckelberg, an optometrist, these huge eyes that are staring out over everything that goes on below. I understand that the cover of the book, the Great Gatsby, the iconic cover that you see that's got the painting with the two eyes looking out, that was actually when that cover was presented to Fitzgerald, he was so stricken by it that he said he wanted to try and incorporate it into the book. And I don't know if this is the way that he incorporated it or not. Nick is dragged off by Tom to visit Myrtle, and all together they go to New York City to the small apartment that Tom rents to carry on this affair with Myrtle. It does seem that Tom really wants to show off to Nick that this is his life, that he's got Daisy and he's got this other woman on the side, this woman who comes from the lower classes because her husband, George, is a runs a garage. And when they're in New York City, there's this kind of a drunken party they all have together, and Myrtle keeps talking about Daisy, and Tom breaks her nose.
Mm-hmm.
Which seems a little severe. It seems like, I felt sort of that Fitzgerald was going out of his way to kind of show that Tom was a brute.
Well, I think I had that same reaction you did, that whenever it seemed a little over the top, but then I felt like Tom's character is very black and white. There weren't many shades to him. He was just the bad guy. You know, I think from the first time you saw him, he wasn't given any that many layers. So when he hit her, it seemed over the top, but kind of in keeping with the way he'd been portrayed up to that point. And I always felt like the last name of Buchanan, now this is nothing that anyone told me, but I felt like that even the name Buchanan was meant to be kind of, you know, brutish, even that choice. That just could be me.
Nick goes back home, and he eventually gets invited to a party at Gatsby's mansion. And when he goes, he sees that it is a crazy party, just full of people, half of whom apparently were not invited. Nobody seems to know who Gatsby is. Nobody sees Gatsby. There's some great depictions of the drunken behavior at the party. There's a guy who crashes a car about 2 seconds after he starts it up. It's funny when you read this because these the scene of the party is so iconic. And when I read it as a teenager, somehow I thought this book was much longer than it was. But as an adult, I realized there's very few scenes in this book. And this one party, I think, sort of stands in for a summer of parties at Gatsby's place. I guess this is what Baz Luhrmann was attracted to from all the trailers I've seen.
Yeah, he created a Moulin Rouge and put it in Gatsby's house is what he did.
Well, Nick actually runs into Gatsby, who turns out to be a funny kind of guy, a kind of a quiet guy who is extremely cheerful. He is attentive. He makes you feel at ease and befriended, but he is obviously lying about everything that he says about his past. He says that he's from the Midwest, and when Nick asks where in the Midwest, he says San Francisco. He says that he was educated in Oxford, and he collected jewels in the capital of Europe and hunted big game. Nick has to laugh because it seems like a litany of all the stories that you might read in a popular magazine. I think that this is Fitzgerald kind of making fun of his own writings for the Saturday Evening Post. But Gatsby, you know, seems like in spite of all of his weirdness, he does seem to be genuinely personable and interested in Nick.
Yeah, I mean, I felt like Gatsby surrounded himself with all this insanity of these parties. But then whenever he had a conversation with Nick, he was the sanest person in the room. And he also chose to hold himself apart. You know, he was usually watching the party as well, kind of above and looking down. So I always felt like he was very sane and very aware. And if he was telling the lies, you know, if he was embroidering his past, I think it was very well-meaning. I liked his character a lot, and I always rooted for him from the very beginning.
Gatsby, after this party, he meets up with Nick a couple times, and he announces in a very awkward way that he's going to ask Jordan to ask Nick to arrange something on his behalf. It's all very cryptic. And it turns out that what Jordan asks is to set up this meeting between Gatsby and Daisy, who knew each other at some point in the past. We get this told in drips throughout the book as we fill in what that past was. But at this point in the book, it seems like enough to know that 5 years ago, their paths crossed and they had a brief romantic relationship. And there's this famous line in here where Gatsby is obviously asking Nick to be the go-between in an affair. And Nick says, you can't repeat the past. And Gatsby says, can't repeat the past. Why, of course you can. So this is Gatsby's great romantic vision, is that he is going to he's going to repeat the past. Not only is he going to repeat the past, he's going to erase the present. He's going to utterly blot out this relationship that Daisy has with Tom. It's around this time that we first see these images of Gatsby looking across the bay to East Egg to a green light at the end of the pier. And that becomes a running image throughout the book of him reaching out his hands, looking to the green light, and becomes sort of a central motif, especially at the end of the book.
Mm-hmm. It's the new money of Gatsby reaching toward the old money, that green light.
On the one hand, I think it's an absolutely beautiful symbol. On the other hand, it's kind of a labored symbol. I keep going back and forth between my admiration for the quality of the prose, which I think is beautiful, and the kind of very simple bareness of the symbols. You know, you say that your teacher was very interested in the symbols, and I think that
she loved them.
I do think that that becomes a crutch when you are dealing with young readers, especially. When we did Lord of the Flies for this podcast, that's one thing that I think really marks that book, is it's got a lot of symbolism that's pretty easy to understand from an allegorical standpoint. And I think that when you're a teenage reader, symbols seem like this great key to enter into the world of the book, you know, to understand. And I don't know that that always is the way that you're supposed to read literature. But Fitzgerald's is an interesting kind of hybrid. He does have these highly symbolic images in his book, but he also has very naturalistic prose.
Yeah, and I think you mentioned earlier about the, you know, the billboard with the eyeglasses or the eyes staring down over the garage. And I remember that was something, that image I thought was very, of course, it was on the cover of the book that I read. And of course, my instructor was very fascinated by that and talking about, you know, those were the all-seeing eyes of God, and how the Myrtle's husband had really looked to those in the movie. And I hate to hearken back to it, but you see him staring out at that billboard like it was speaking to him. And I don't know, I think one of the things, maybe when you're talking about symbols, as a reader, if I just read that book myself and hadn't seen the movie, I don't know that a lot of that would have been obvious to me. I don't know. It was hard for me to read it, you know, as a naive person, because I had seen something. But I think some of that, I agree, is to me, I prefer symbols that weren't blatantly obvious, that things that are a little more, you feel like if you figure out what he's doing, that it's a reward, or, you know, it's like a mystery that you've solved it a little bit earlier before the end of the book. But when they become maybe a little too sprinkled throughout and you're starting to see a pattern, then maybe it loses some of its magic.
Nick does set up a tea at his house and invites Daisy over, and Gatsby's there too. They have a kind of a meet cute where Gatsby is extremely shy and hesitant, but they do end up meeting, and we learn more about their story, that Gatsby had met Daisy 5 years earlier when he was in the army, and at that point he was not well to do enough. He could not support Daisy, and so while they had had this brief romantic interlude, they could not get married. And shortly after that, Daisy had met Tom Buchanan and gotten married. And in quick succession, she had a baby. And the thing that's funny about this baby is it gets mentioned maybe twice in the book. You would think that it would be mentioned more, but it's obvious that when Gatsby has this fantasy that he and Daisy are going to get back together, there's no place in this fantasy for Tom and Daisy's daughter.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's one of the things, and you can tell me what you think, but I find really interesting is that, you know, Gatsby had, you know, started with nothing, had this goal that he was going to get Daisy back, and he achieves all this, you know, success, and then he is so hesitant and shy when he sees her, when clearly they had been to the point of wanting to marry. So I found that hesitancy somewhat out of character. You know, it was an interesting thing for me. At that point, I was frustrated. I remember reading it. I was frustrated with him as to why he was being so hesitant and why he needed all of this help to make this happen.
Right. It seems almost as though Fitzgerald is trying to put a little bit of levity into what is a kind of a somber book, because there's this business where Gatsby leans into a clock on the mantelpiece and knocks it off and has to catch it and fumbles around. And it's not really funny enough to be funny, but it is funny enough to seem to stick out from a tone standpoint for the rest of the book. Mm-hmm. And maybe, as you say, not really seem like Gatsby. But Gatsby has this character, as you said before, of standing back, of observing, of trying to ingratiate himself to people. It's only towards the end of the book, when he thinks he's got his goal in sight, that he really tries to assert his personality strongly, which is interesting for a guy who is really, really trying to push his way ahead in the world. It does seem as though Gatsby is trying to sneak in under people's radar.
Yeah, and you know, the funny thing too, from a woman's point of view, is that the character of Daisy seemed to me, I know she was his golden girl and everything, but she seemed to me almost, she seemed so fragile that I wondered if that was also part of that interplay, because in his interactions with her and when her interactions with Tom, even with Nick, she seemed like at any point she could just shatter, just because any word could turn her, you know, from happy to sad. Or I often felt in my heart that she was actually may have had some mental issues.
Well, if she is based in part on Zelda Fitzgerald, Zelda Fitzgerald eventually was put into a mental ward. She was being treated for schizophrenia, but it seems more likely that she had a manic depressive disorder. Mm-hmm. And that seems very like Daisy, the kind of happy and sad. One of the things that's unfortunate is that Daisy is very disliked by a lot of readers. I know that she was disliked by all the readers in my high school who kind of saw her as, again, selfish or reactionary, like she never really took control of her own life and she let all these things happen around her. At the end of the book, of course, she lets someone else take the fall for something she's done. But I do think that Daisy is like a lot of women in early 20th century novels, in that there's an expectation that her life could have more opportunity for agency and for self-determination, but there still isn't a society out there that's going to support her in that. So all that she has to look forward to is finding someone rich and connected like Tom and living a kind of a high society life, and that doesn't seem to make her very happy at all. She has that famous line at the beginning of the book where she does talk about her baby, saying the best thing in life for a woman is to be a fool, to be a beautiful fool, because that's all she can see leading to happiness for women in this world.
Yeah, that was probably the moment she seemed the most self-aware, because the rest of the time it felt like she was kind of drifting somewhere on the fringes of every conversation. And yeah, so it was, I have to admit, it was hard to like her, because I felt like she was playing Tom when she needed Tom, and then she was playing Gatsby when she needed him. And part of me would think, well, you know, Gatsby has all the money you would need, so I don't know why you're hesitating. But to your point, he didn't have the social position that she needed as well.
They do have an affair that goes on over the summer, and because nobody is good at keeping any secrets in this story, Tom catches on rather quickly, partly because they at a lunch where Gatsby attends at Tom and Daisy's house, Daisy kisses Gatsby on the mouth.
That's not obvious at all.
No. Well, Tom says that he's going to find out what's going on with this Gatsby fellow. Why? Who is he? Where did he come from? And he starts investigating. We don't know exactly how, but the story doesn't really concern itself with that. It just lets us know that eventually it's come out that Jay Gatsby was actually born James Gatz from North Dakota, that he had worked on a farm and dropped out of college. He'd trained in the infantry where he met Daisy during World War One. It appears that he actually did briefly attend Oxford, so he may not have been lying about that. But on returning to the United States after his European excursions, he became a bootlegger and made the acquaintance of Meyer Wolfsheim, this connection to organized crime who keeps following Gatsby around the place. It seems through Meyer Wolfsheim's continued appearance in the book that Gatsby probably is still involved either in bootlegging or other unsavory activities. One of the things that I think is well handled by the book is the fact that Tom complains loudly about Gatsby being a bootlegger while he has absolutely no problem with drinking or serving drinks at his parties. And, you know, the rich certainly have no lack of access to alcohol in this world, but it's still considered very, very low rent to be a bootlegger.
Yeah, that is interesting. But I grew up in Kentucky where we had moonshiners, so that made perfect sense to me.
Right, right. In a big, ugly scene towards the end of the book, Tom drags everyone to the Plaza Hotel in New York. This seems to be the way Tom likes to operate. He likes to take everyone into the city to have these ugly parties. And at this party at the Plaza Hotel, Gatsby makes his move. He thinks he's got Daisy on his side, and he tells Tom that Daisy never loved Tom. But when Tom reveals all this stuff about Gatsby's history, Daisy kind of falls in line and is not going to go along with Gatsby's plan to leave Tom and run off with Gatsby. And in fact, at that point, Tom tells Daisy to go home in Gatsby's car, because this is kind of like rubbing their nose in it, because he says, "You're so in my pocket at this point, I don't even care. Gatsby will take you home and you won't say anything else." Now, on the way back from New York City, Nick, who again is kind of tagging along because he tags along everywhere, is driving with Tom, and they find that Myrtle, who, as we all remember, is Nick's mistress, Myrtle Wilson, has been hit by a car and killed. We have a kind of a flashback scene where we can see that Myrtle had been locked in her room by her husband, who, suspecting a affair on the part of his wife, it turns out he's correct, was keeping her under lock and key until he could arrange to leave the Valley of Ashes. But when Myrtle makes her way out of the house, she runs into the street. She's trying to flag down the car that hits her. And when Nick gets home, he finds Gatsby, and Gatsby admits that, yes, it was his car. We pretty much knew that anyway, because a bystander says that it was a yellow car, and the only yellow car we've seen in the entire book belonged to Gatsby, but that Daisy was actually driving the car, probably drunk at that point. And Gatsby says that he's going to take the fall for Daisy. He's going to claim to be driving himself. And you want to jump in here with anything here?
No, I mean, this is just where I'm, if you could see me, I'm just shaking my head. This frustrated me as well, because here she had already rejected him, right? And said she was going to stay with Tom. And then they get in the car and they drive away, which frustrates me that he would go with her. And then he takes the fall for her hitting Myrtle. So, again, it was the frustration with with Gadsby, his inability to act independent of you know, Daisy's feelings and Daisy's actions, which, again, just as a reader, I speak just as a reader and as a woman, it was very frustrating to see that happen.
Right. Well, later that night, Myrtle's husband, George Wilson, comes to Gatsby's mansion, where Gatsby is lying on a floating mattress in his pool after spending the entire book saying that he's never used his own pool. The one time he uses his own pool, George shows up and shoots him dead and then kills himself. So we have a Hamlet-style tragedy here where people are just dropping like flies at the end of the book.
But at mansions, which is really nice.
At mansions, right. And there's a kind of an epilogue here where we see Nick is trying to put Gatsby's affairs in order. Nobody wants to show up for Gatsby's funeral. None of his underworld connections, none of the people from his parties want to show up. But his father does show up. His father, Henry Gats, comes from the Midwest and shows Nick a very sad notebook that Gatsby, and then Jimmy Bet Gats, kept when he was a kid. It's full of all these plans for self-betterment. And so we can see that from a very young age, Gatsby was interested in advancement and achieving. We also see that Nick has become completely disenchanted with this world of East Egg and West Egg and the whole East Coast. He breaks things off with Jordan. He runs into Tom in New York City, and Tom admits that on the night that Gatsby was shot, George had shown up at his place first, and he told George that the car belonged to Gatsby, knowing that George would go and shoot him. And strangely, this seems to this doesn't make Nick any angrier with Tom. It just makes Nick kind of accept that this is just the way Nick is. Tom is, because Tom is just always going to be a jerk, and Tom is always going to see things from his standpoint and how he can use people. And there is this passage in which Nick reflects on the fact that this is this story taking place on the East Coast has fully featured people from the West, from the Middle West and further West, and that they've come back to the East, and the East has been sort of a corrupting influence on them all, he thinks.
I do think you have to think about, you know, Nick was so proud of how honest he was and non-judgmental. And I think if you look at all the characters in the book, Tom was probably the most honest and straightforward. I mean, he lived his life a certain way. He was a brute, I suppose, and he had affairs. But I never felt like he, he did lie, obviously, as far as who killed Myrtle. But I mean, then he fully admits it to Nick when he didn't have to. So I felt like there's an honesty to Tom's character, even though he's definitely the character we're supposed to hate. And you do. But if Nick respects honesty, then he has to respect that Tom is exactly who he says he is. And that's, you know, that kind of, maybe when honesty smacks Nick in the face and he realizes he doesn't like it that much.
Nick has this scene where he's lying on the beach and he thinks about the Dutch settlers coming to this country, and he thinks about them seeing the pristine island ahead of them and how full of opportunity it is and how it sort of represents an American dream. And he talks about this American dream being over. And then there is this last passage here, the most famous ending, I think, in any American novel.
And as I sat there brooding on the old unknown world, I thought of Gatsby's wonder when he first picked out the green light at the end of Daisy's dock. He had come a long way to this blue lawn, and his dream must have seemed so close that he could hardly fail to grasp it. He did not know that it was already behind him, somewhere back in that vast obscurity beyond the city, where the dark fields of the Republic rolled on under the night. Gatsby believed in the green light, the orgastic future that year by year recedes before us. It eluded us then, but that's no matter. Tomorrow we will run faster, stretch out our arms farther, and one fine morning. So we beat on, boats against the current, borne back ceaselessly into the past.
For myself, to me, this book and the ending especially has a very personal connection, because for someone like myself who grew up in a really small town and the lure of the, coming to the big city, coming to New York City, to the Northeast, and trying to blaze your own trail or whatever, you can never escape, you know, where you came from. And I think that this book, even though when I saw the movie and then when I read the book, that was never really in the forefront of my mind, but I felt like that was very much the message. Even though Gatsby said you can repeat the past, he didn't mean it in the sense that the past kind of haunts you. So I always kid people and say that no matter where you go and no matter what you do, you'll always be that teenage kid that you were in high school, because that's a part of you that you can't escape. So I think the that ending too kind of drove that home a little bit for me.
Well, that ending, I think more than anything else in this book, is why this book gets shortlisted for the Great American Novel. It ties it up into kind of a neat bow, everything that's happened, to talk about how in a society that's supposed to be classless, we still have class. In a society where you're supposed to be able to achieve anything that you put your mind to, you really can't, because you're always being held back by society's expectations. But, you know, when I was reading the book again as, just this last week to prepare for this, one of the things that struck me is that the action of the novel, I don't think necessarily supports that reading so much. I think that in some ways the action of the novel is a much smaller scale than that. It's Gatsby's pursuit of Daisy, that very specific pursuit of Daisy, and his inability to let go of this conception he has of her. And while I do think that Fitzgerald invites the reading that this book is a larger critique on the whole process of self-improvement and self-betterment and of the American dream, I don't know. That seems to me more kind of tacked on than it did when I was a teenager. Partly because when I was a teenager, I took it for on faith that what my teacher was telling me was true. And now that I'm a grown-up, I kind of like to make my own decisions about these things. And it seems like Fitzgerald is trying to make a decision for me about how I should take the message of the story. But it still is an incredibly beautiful passage.
Oh, absolutely. And I do think, to your point about the, this is a like one smaller story, and maybe they've tried to make the message bigger. The point, though, too, is in all of our individual pursuits for that American dream, there can be these little smaller actions that hold us back, or these relationships that hold us back. And so if I were trying to help Fitzgerald out, I'd say that even though this is a small little subset, I think it does kind of illustrate the things that can hold us back, even when we have these huge possibilities, which obviously Gatsby had. But that one thing really, ultimately ended his life.
Well, when you think about this as a book for high schoolers, it's a kind of a funny book, again, because it is a book about the limitations of our hopes and dreams. And that's kind of a hard lesson to be giving kids right when they kind of have the most hopes and dreams in their life, or maybe when they're making their first tentative steps out into a world full of hopes and dreams where they're not exactly sure what they're going to achieve.
Well, one of the reasons I think it might have been so popular is that it is showing that not everything's achievable, but if you actually broke it down as a sophomore in high school and said, well, why didn't they succeed? Well, in some ways you could look at it as a big morality play, in the sense that, oh, well, you could look at the sins that they committed as working against them. So I'm not saying that our parents and our teachers are necessarily doing this intentionally, but I think there is a little bit of that in saying that, you know, you succeed based on not only your talent, but also how good of a person you are. And I think there is a little bit, there's a lot of that in there as far as there's a certain spirituality in this book, and it may be misplaced, of what people worship and what they should and shouldn't. And again, no judgments, as Nick said, but I think there definitely are a lot of judgments, and how people lived their life impacted how well they did. Although I can't, as I say that, obviously Tom and Daisy monetarily do quite well, but they're obviously the most miserable people in the book.
Well, any final words you want to leave our audience with?
Well, one thing, and this has to do with the movie more than the book, in the movie version, which I really hope you see the Robert Redford, Mia Farrow version from 1974, because I really loved it. I think it really embraces the tone of the book as well as the story. There is one character that goes to a party at Gatsby's house and he never leaves. He played the piano and just ended up spending the night, and he never leaves Gatsby's house, even though Gatsby doesn't know him. And he was played by Edward Herman, which is a great actor, a great character actor, who's most recently known as the grandfather on the Gilmore Girls, and he recently died. So I encourage you, that was one of his first movie roles ever, and I think it's just a great little bit of trivia from The Great Gatsby.
Well, I'll look out for that. Thanks.
You should.
I'd like to thank Carla Kurtzinger for joining me. I'd also like to thank my pal Paul Horn for again providing the reading. Visit him on the web at paulhorn.com. If you'd like to email me, not that anyone ever does, you can do so using sophomore.literature@gmail.com, or look for the Sophomore Lit Facebook page and leave comments there. Our next book will either be A Separate Piece or The Scarlet Letter. You know what? Read them both. As always, everything will be on the final.